Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. For the past 44 years, Bob Ryan has been covering the local sports scene for the Boston Globe. He's covered it all: Celtics, Bruins, Patriots, college basketball, and the Red Sox, including this memorable moment in October 2004.
Before that historic World Series win, Bob Ryan covered the great years of the Celtics, and for his deep knowledge of the NBA, he became known as the Commissioner. He covered the Patriots, wrote about the Bruins' Stanley Cup win in 2011, banged out columns on 29 Final Fours and 11 Olympics, including this summer's games in London. He's even covered a dog show.
After graduating from Boston College in 1968, Ryan started working at the Boston Globe as a summer intern and never left. More than four decades later, he's finally retired as a full-time sports writer, though retirement is probably not the right word. He'll continue writing a weekly column, and he's just finished an e-book called The Best of Bob Ryan, 44 Gems from the Legendary Sports Writer. And he's with us now to look back on a long and remarkable career. And Bob Ryan, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. What's your questions for Bob Ryan? Nobody knows more about the local and national sports scenes than this gentleman. So give us a call. Join the conversation. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Bob, how did you know that the time had come to hang it up as a full-time sports writer? I'm not using the word retirement because it doesn't sound like you're really retiring.
It is a technical term, retirement. I've decided this means you're no longer in the full-time employee of a company. I'm off the payroll. As of the 13th of August, I'm off the payroll. But you're right. There is an afterlife coming. I would be writing 30 to 40 times a year. That's the plan. Worked out with my sports editor, Joe Sullivan. How did I know? I think that... it's a combination. There's no one thing. It was just that time is absolutely right for me. I can feel the beginning of a wane in overall enthusiasm for the task. And that's something that's been my calling card, I think, if you would consult my contemporaries. And I didn't want to risk having it that show in the work. I made up my mind a long time ago after observing other people that I did not want to be that guy. I looked at that. I said, I don't want to be him. I don't want to be hanging around and having people say, what's he doing here? I don't want people saying, oh, you know, he's lost his fastball. I really wanted to get out while I thought I still had something that wanted to do, and they still wanted me to stay.
You know, you mentioned your enthusiasm, and your colleague Dan Shaughnessy wrote in the introduction to this ebook that he wrote something that I thought was really poignant about the way you write. He wrote, Bob never lost his passion for the games. Into his mid-60s, he still cares as much about the games as the rest of us did when we were 12 years old. He was never infected with the cynicism gene. And I think he's right about that. When I read your stuff, I hear the passion and the concern. How do you sustain that? How did you sustain that?
I can't
that?
Explain it. It's just what's in me. I do think it's what separates me from the other older writers. And it's almost a given in the business that you will become a cynic. And I have resisted that. Hmm. I think you must always, as a writer, be a skeptic.
Right.
I think that's a big distinction. A skeptic, you have to question. You have to not automatically accept all the conventional wisdom or all the opinions or the viewpoint of management or the establishment, whatever it may be. But I think that's skepticism. But cynicism means you come with a preconceived notion of antagonism or of disbelief and I don't have that. I never had that. I'm blessed, frankly, to have that. That's something that I mean to have this particular makeup, and I'm proud of it. But there's nothing that I've ever worked on. It's just who I am.
Well, let me ask you about your big love. I want to talk about all the sports that you've covered. You became known as the commissioner, as we mentioned. And again, I want to read something else that Dan Shaughnessy wrote in that introduction to the ebook. He calls it a tribute to the commissioner. And this is what he wrote. Ryan changed the way the NBA was covered. He was the final word on every basketball argument. And elsewhere, he said, Ryan really is the de facto commissioner. Before the NBA Finals game at the Staples Center a few years ago, I came up behind Ryan and NBA Commissioner David Stern as they were deep in conversation, and I said, excuse me, Commissioner. Both men turned around to address my question. True story, says Dan Shaughnessy.
He loves that story. He loves a couple of stories. He loves a couple of other stories about me. And Dan Shaughnessy has been one of my great public boosters and private boosters as well. As I told him, he's had my back better than anybody else in the business, and I'm really grateful for that. Even though we don't agree on a lot of things, and really we have very, very different viewpoints towards the job that we both love, but we still are united with our love of newspapers and journalism. Yes, it happened, and he just loves that story.
Well, where did that come from? Or let me just ask you specifically, what does he mean that you changed the way the NBA
was covered? I'm not sure. I think I'm getting a little too much credit here, quite frankly. I don't know that. I think, frankly, I only know one sports writer and of my experience and of my historical knowledge, if you will, who really changed the way the games are covered, and that was Dick Young of the New York Daily News, the way he covered baseball starting in the 40s. Hard to believe the way things are today with all the emphasis on the pregame press conferences and the postgame press conferences and all the issues about whether or not players talk to the media or how they talk to the media, that until Dick Young, you didn't talk to people after the game. Guys, watch the writers, watch the baseball. And every, by the way, I'm referring to baseball because baseball is the number one historical precedent for everything that we know in sports in America today in terms of coverage. So in the old days, you watched a baseball game, which is probably played in the afternoon, and you wrote what you saw, and that's it. And you banged it out in your typewriter, and you handed it to the Western Union guy, and you went and had dinner. And then the next day, before the game, you may have chatted with the manager or occasional habit, or you might have run into the player at the lobby at the hotel where you stayed at that night, but you didn't. Dick Young marched down into that locker room and asked questions about what had happened that afternoon or evening in the game, and set and chained in the chain of events in motion that we know today. I don't know what I did to warrant that kind of very nice excessive praise from Dan. I think I did certain things that I'm proud of, and I'm proud of the way I wrote about the game. But in terms of the coverage, I just built on predecessors. I think if he feels that way, great. You'd have to ask him about if be specific.
All right, I will. I'll do that one of these days. But I mean, I think what he's getting at is just you not only analyze, you not only educate, but you do it all within the framework of a terrific story. And looking through the ebook, there's some great stories in there. And let me just talk to you about one. You wrote a terrific piece about Larry Bird. This was Game 5, Eastern Conference Final, Celtics versus Detroit Pistons. Detroit is up by 1 point, 4 seconds left. The game is over for all intents and purposes, right? I mean, they're going to put the ball in play and run out the clock, and what happens?
And what happens is that Isaiah Thomas lost focus and threw a sloppy inbounds pass, and Larry Bird intercepted it. But then, see, it's a collaborative thing. Larry's gotten way too much credit for everything here, because after Larry intercepted the pass, he is perched, balanced like a flamingo on one leg, almost falling out of bounds. And if Dennis Johnson hadn't surveyed the situation from the top of the key and cut to the basket to give Larry a passing outlet, Dennis Johnson made the winning basket. Absent the cut, Larry stole the ball, and that's nice, but nothing would have happened.
Yeah.
He would have fallen out of bounds with it, and that would have been the end of it. But because it was Larry Bird, he gets a disproportionate amount of the credit. It was a very much a 50-50 deal.
I see.
But Larry didn't quit. Because there were the 4 seconds to go. It was 47 minutes and 56 seconds.
Yeah.
That's not 48. And Larry always thought that way.
And you said that. It's a great line. The message is clear. If you want to beat Larry Bird in a game, you've got to play the full 48 minutes. 47 minutes, 56 seconds isn't enough.
Right. Well, you know, you indulge in hyperbole a little bit. But
it's terrific.
But that's the way Larry thought.
Yeah. So is he the best Celtics ever?
Bill Russell remains the standard of winning excellence. He's the greatest winner in the history of American sport with the 11 championships and the gold medals and the NCAA championships. So you have to give him, but in terms of playing a position with and having more of a range of skill and having an impact in a different time, a different way, everything changed so dramatically from 69 when Russell last played until Bird came along. I would say that he's the greatest all-around player, but I'm you must start with Bill Russell. Everything in the Boston Celtics winning championship history starts with Bill Russell.
Mm. Well, listeners, we're talking to the great Boston Globe sports writer, Bob Ryan. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And we're talking to Bob just a few days after the start of his, we're not calling it, no, we came up with a better word, not retirement.
I'm calling it phase two.
Phase two.
I'm in phase two, and it means I'm going to write periodically, and that's a different dynamic, and I don't know how I'm
And you can write what you want, when you want.
Right, do it when I want, and on Sundays it's going to be, and I will advertise it. The first one will be Sunday, September 9th, because I'm going to be away next week, and but I'll have it ready to go. And then we'll see how that works out, because running once a week is a different kind of a pressure and dynamic than writing three or four times a week.
Well, let's take some calls. We've got a lot of listeners who want to get on this conversation. Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Revere. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. What's on your mind?
I just want to commend Bob for 40 years of great sports writing. I'm a native Bostonian, and I've always read his column, and I lived in California for a while, and I would compare you to the great Jim Murray.
Well, he was my idol. There were two great influences on my career, on my thinking. One was Jim Murray. I fell in love with Jim Murray when I was about 13 or 14 and read him on a syndicated basis in Philadelphia. I grew up in New Jersey, in Trenton, New Jersey, but he was in the Philadelphia Inquirer. I became aware of him, and thank you for that, because he's somebody that means a great deal to me. And the other influence would be Frank DeFord of Sports Illustrated, who
terrific writer.
He's as graceful as
we had him in here not long ago talking about his latest book.
His memoir book. But anyway, thank you for the Jim Murray, because Jim Murray is, in fact, the person who more singly influenced me than anyone when I was an adolescent.
Chris was mentioning our caller there that he grew up in California, became a Boston sports writer. You originally grew up in New Jersey. What led to this passion about Boston sports?
Nothing. I had no predisposition until I arrived as a Boston College freshman in September of 1964. And the very first week I was there, they won we beat Syracuse on the last second pass from Larry Marzetti to Bill Cronin. And that was a nice initiation into Boston College sports and Boston sports. And I was covering the game for the Trenton Times. I had been a copy boy for them that summer. And it was the debut of Floyd Little, if you remember that name, who became a great player for the Denver Broncos and Syracuse University. He had played his prep school ball in the Trenton area. So anyway, but I had no great overt feeling for Boston. It's all been developed since I've been here.
Interesting. Let's take another call. Maggie is calling from Bellingham. Hi, Maggie. You're on the air with Bob Ryan.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
It's funny you brought up Frank DeFord, because I was going to say you've been kind of Boston's Frank DeFord. I grew up grown up in Boston, and my mom used to be a writer for the Patriot Ledger, and you know, when I was a kid, we had some of the greatest teams. We had the Bruins with Esposito and Orr and McKenzie, and we had the Celtics with Larry Bird and some of the folks you were talking about. But even when we had our slumps, and we've had them, I think the thing that I loved about your style of writing was that you kept us dreaming and you kept an enthusiasm in your work. That, I definitely came from a family where we checked the political page and the sports page first.
Maggie, thanks so much for that call. That's terrific. Keeping your enthusiasm even when times are bad.
Well, that's easy for me, because the game, see, the thing, we get back to what you were talking about a few minutes ago, the game thing. Mm. And if I have anything that I do think that separates me, as I said, from people, particularly contemporaries now, it's the fact that I can get interested in a game for its own sake, and it doesn't have to have a context necessarily. Mm. So, for example, I went to the ballpark yesterday with my wife and with good friends Jimmy Isaacs and Andy Zellman, and it was a wonderful 2 hours and 34 minutes of athletic entertainment. And it was a beautiful, sunny, I don't have to tell you what yesterday was like.
Sure.
And it was spent at the ballpark, and that's one of the favorite places for me to spend time. I'm a season ticket holder of the last 20 years, and had a rare opportunity this particular year to go to the game and sit in my own seat, which we did. And it was a wonderful game, a great catch by Dyson in center field, robbing Pedroia. It was a perfect catch of a timing, taking away a double or a triple, Dice Case pitching, Ellsbury's homer in a double. It was just a wonderful day. I love the game, and we had something to talk about the game, and I can put games in context. See, I mean, a lot of people talk about, I like to write about people. You know, well, big deal. If you're a writer, you damn well better be able to write about people. No,
right.
Seriously.
No,
that's
a
prerequisite
yeah,
to have a humanity, feeling of humanity and have an ability to put the words together to capture certain things and describe people and get in and ask the right questions. Yeah. I don't consider that a great... Some people are better than others at it, and I'm not the best at it, but I'm okay at it. But show me... there's a lot more difficult things to write about to do as a writer than write a profile. Trust me on this.
Well, I can hear your enthusiasm even today about the game. I want to ask you about one in particular. I wanted to move on to the Red Sox. I was looking at a couple of the pieces in the ebook. You wrote a great piece in September 1999 about Pedro Martinez. He throws a one-hit shutout against the New York Yankees in New York in the midst of a pennant race in which he struck out 17 people. Of course, many of us remember that game. But talk about a game.
It's funny. I didn't see the game. That Friday, it was a Friday night. I don't know what... We had something going on. The Red Sox were in New York for the weekend. I went down on Saturday. And that's a day after story. And I went to David Cohn of the Yankees then, who had pitched a perfect game in his career, and he said that's a better pitch game than my perfect game. That's the best pitch game I have ever seen. Yeah. And then from that was an easy jumping off point for me, and I went on to write that piece and to try to put the 1999 Pedro Martinez in context. And that's really what the purpose of that piece was. And I've seen it, you know, I've looked at it, and I'm quite proud of that piece. I mean, I think I put the 1999 Pedro Martinez in context. That was my goal.
He was something then, wasn't he? Have we seen anything like him?
We haven't. As much as I love Louis Tiant, and he's my, and maybe if I had to pick a guy that I'd want to see pitch a game in his prime for the theatrics and the showmanship as well as the skill, I would pick him. Okay, I saw the best of Roger many times. Saw the best of Roger. Roger was spectacular in his prime. Pedro's the best. He's the best. I mean, his stuff was better than both of them. That 1999-2000 Pedro is frankly the best post Koufax pitcher baseball has seen. There's a guy right now in Seattle who's going to threaten that
no
that
kidding.
Statement.
Who's that?
Felix Hernandez is approaching that level, I'm telling you. But Pedro is the best post-Koufax pitcher baseball has known.
1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK to make the connection with Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. He's been writing great stories about sports that we've all been appreciating for the last 44 years or so. Give us a call. Eric is calling from Amherst. Hi, Eric. You're on the air with Bob Ryan.
Hi, thank you. I first wanted to say that I've been a huge fan of Mr. Ryan. I'm a huge NBA fan for my entire life, and I had a quick question for him about that. I was wondering, as one of the most interesting, insightful, creative, and enthusiastic beat writers in NBA history, and you've been doing it for 44 years, do you have any intention to eventually take all of your experiences and all your insider knowledge and write a definitive history of the NBA?
That has been done by someone, Bill Simmons, who I must say actually says in his book that he did it because he got tired of waiting for me to do it. And that was very, very, very flattering of him to say that. I think that I'm not topping. There's no way I'm topping that book. What I do have hopes of doing, however, Eric, is a book that would encompass a lot of my experiences and feelings and about the NBA, which has been obviously the number one central shaping thing in my quote-unquote career, and in addition to other things. But that would be where it would be. But to attempt to have a full-fledged history that would try to exceed what Bill Simmons has done, I think that's a fruitless task.
Eric, thanks so much for the call. Let me come back to a conversation about the game. You wrote another fabulous piece about Game 7 of the 2003 American League Championship Series. Of course, that was the heartbreaker when the Red Sox were just 5 outs from advancing to the World Series. But, of course, they lost. Pedro Martinez figured big
very
in that
big.
Game as well.
Yes.
That wasn't the 1999 Pedro Martinez.
I'm very proud of that story. And, boy, this is a bad blowing your own horn thing, but we're here.
No, that's what we're here to do.
That story appeared in – it was my first appearance ever in the anthology well-known to many people called Best Sports Stories. And that's an anthology that's been going on in some form or another with different publishers and editors and so forth since approximately 1944. I grew up reading those books and dreaming about being involved in that book, but I never got the call until that story. So I'm very happy about that, but what I'm proud of is this. That happens to be the last piece in that anthology that was a Deadline story.
Huh.
Every single piece that has appeared starting in 1994 And I haven't seen the new one. And every year when the new one comes out, I race into it to see if my, you know, it's kind of like the Dolphins, you know, when the last team loses and they break out the champagne, mm-hmm. that they're the last undefeated team. I'm totally proud of that because the book was once emphasis was on deadline writing, and now it's about everybody's in it. It's written magazine pieces. They may have had a month, 2 months. It's a different kind of writing. I am proudest of deadline writing. That's the nexus of a newspaper business to me, and so that's the last piece. So I'm rather happy you brought that one up because I'm inordinately proud of that.
Well, it's a terrific piece. It jumped right out of the ebook as far as I was concerned, and of course, you know, one of those great sort of milestone markers in the long legacy of Red Sox disappointment. This was pre-2004. You had a great line in there. Thus, we have another gigantic log to toss in the eternal flame of Red Sox misery.
True. It was. And you know, it was funny. That was nice. What I remember as much as anything else was that after listening to Grady Little's explanation,
yeah.
I said he has now managed. I said he's managed his last game as a Red Sox. This won't sell.
Yeah.
This cannot sell, and it didn't.
And, of course, the next year the Red Sox finally win the 2004 World Series after a terrific comeback against the Yankees. I know your heart, the biggest piece of your heart is in basketball, but was that the biggest story of the 44 years here?
Unequivocally, yes, yeah. Because the whole thing about the alleged curse and the whole history of it, and I mean, I certainly had gotten immersed enough in the history of it, going back to the 46 and seventh game and all that, and I lived through 67 very passionately and personally as a fan, in between my junior and senior year at BC. I spent the entire summer here. I went to 27 games that year, a lot of them with my then girlfriend, now wife of 43 years, Elaine, and that meant, but that absolutely to be able to have my little say about this historic moment is something, and that's the number one story. And the second one would have to be, the Patriots, the rise of the Patriots, and the Patriots winning a Super Bowl because of anyone who knows their tortured history,
sure,
and how much of it centered on buffoonery, not excellence, as it does now. That was certainly very big.
Mm. Well, I can't let you go without just asking you a little bit about today's Red Sox, and let me just get your comment on the big blockbuster trade last weekend, or do we call it a purge? I'm not sure if it's trade or a purge.
It is a purge, and from the Red Sox point of view, but you need somebody that'll be the party of the second part. The blissful and utterly unimaginable circumstance that there exists a team that had the need or a desire to acquire those kind of players and was willing to absorb the contracts at the precise moment in time when it would both benefit you and a time when baseball ordinarily cannot accommodate such deals post-trade deadline. So if someone proposed this scenario before the season, you say, it's impossible. It never happened before. It's not going to happen. Hmm. So they're extraordinarily fortunate that the Dodgers were purchased by who they were purchased, the hedge group led by Ms. Mark Walter, and that they got, it wasn't the, and the Dodgers have a need to for their own purposes, they needed to make a splash in the post-Frank McCourt era. And they both served each other's needs in a way that we never could have foreseen, say, at the start of this season or any other season. So it's a monumental deal.
Monumental deal. And do you think it's going to lead them to a better place in literally the 10 seconds we have?
Yeah, it not necessarily. Michael Silverman at Boston Herald today summed it up beautifully. If they spend the money wisely, and do we have a guarantee that they will based on their recent history? No, we do not.
Hmm. Well, Bob Ryan, such a pleasure. Thank you for 4 decades of terrific writing, and thank you for coming in and talking to us today. We appreciate it.
I'm very flattered that you would have me. Thank you.
Bob Ryan has been a sports writer and columnist for the Boston Globe for the last 44 years. He has a new ebook called The Best of Bob Ryan, 44 Gems from the Legendary Sports Writer. You can find a link to it right here at Radio Boston.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.